Okay, so I want to welcome everybody after we missed last week for Yom Ha'atzma'ut, and now we're back, of course, talking about Israel, modern day Israel, and a pleasure to welcome back Shuli to enlighten us. Bakasha.
Yes. Hey, hi everybody. So if last week we talked about settlement and the first Aliyah, a little bit about the second Aliyah, today we are going to go more in the direction of politics. We're going to go backwards and we're going to go forwards. We are fancy footwork. And we are going to talk about the Ottomans, the British, but we're also going to go back to Herzl, who we kind of skipped over last time. So we're going to get to that. Just one second. Sorry, I'm on a different computer. It's a little bit slower. But it will work eventually, Be'ezrat Hashem. So we are going from the Ottomans to the British. Very formative years for everybody, pretty much. Okay, these are formative years for the Jews. This is what we call the Medina Shebaderech, the state in the making. We're no longer in this really embryonic state of the Chovev Beit Zion. And is everybody seeing me? Because I'm not seeing you. So I'm worried about that. Rabbi Kalman,
you see fine. Me? I see your timeline, Ottoman Empire, British Empire, the nice coin, Palestine.
Okay, I don't know why I'm not seeing you guys. But okay, as long as you're seeing me, that's fine. So these are formative years for the Jews. We've moved forward. We're talking about leadership and infrastructure and money, right? All those things are starting to happen. They are formative years for the Arabs, who did not have a strong nationalism. There's pan-Arabism, right? There's the whole Arab world, but there isn't a strong nationalism in the sense of Arab nationalism, specifically in Eretz Israel, in Palestine. So that's going to develop in these years. And the British, sorry, I'm just going to, because this is bugging me that I can't see you all. I'd like to be able to do both. So let me just stop sharing for one moment. Sorry. And for the British, these are formative years because we are talking about, their hopes for the future, right? Of what's, okay, here we go. Beautiful. That's what I wanted. Talking about their hopes for creating some kind of harmony, some kind of coexistence between the Jews and the Arabs. And that doesn't really come to fruition. And we're going to see that the dreams of Herzl and the dreams of the mandate do not happen the way that everybody thought. There's not a peaceful creation of a state, of two states, of a binational state. And that's what we're going to talk about next time, is really the War of Independence. But that's, so everybody, these are very important years for everyone. And that's what we're really going to be talking about. So let's go into this. The picture is, I love this picture. There's a lot of stuff online from the times of the mandate. People are very fascinated by it. And this is a coin, right? A coin from the mandate. And what I find very interesting about it is that you see, first of all, the three languages, right? Arabic, English, and Hebrew. You see Palestine, of course, is the name that the British gave to the country, but in Hebrew, Palestina, and in parentheses, Aleph Yud, Eretz Israel, right? So they're acknowledging that the Jews are calling this the land of Israel. And you also have the regular date, right? The Arabic numerals, 1927, and the date that the Arabs use. So the Arab letters. So we have all of those different pieces, and it's all in this coin and this feeling that everybody can work together and everything is going to work out. Okay, sorry, I'm just having glitches today. I'm going to stop sharing to get rid of this window and then I'm going to share again. Okay, so let's take a look at the timeline. Okay, and again, the timeline is what we are talking about in terms of all of these great changes, a lot of political development, a lot of political change, starting with really with Herzl, but I put in Eliezer Ben Yehuda because we're going to talk about him too. Eliezer Ben Yehuda emigrates to Palestine already in 1881, even before the first Aliyah, and he's going to be part of our story of language, very significant. Herzl, 1895, writes this formative pamphlet called The Jewish State, and by 1897 has managed to form the first Jewish Congress, gathering of Jewry, of world Jewry in 2,000 years, right? That's how it was built, and that's really what it is. A couple of years later, in 1898, he visits Palestine. We have the Uganda proposal, which Herzl is for, and everybody else. This divides the Congress bitterly. The idea that we'll take Uganda over Eretz Yisrael, and in the wake of the dismay that Herzl feels over the rejection of Uganda, he dies. He dies in 1904. 1904 to 1914, second Aliyah. Okay, also not so big, but very, very significant in terms of the people in terms of the ideas that they have, but all of it cut short by the trauma of World War One. World War One is a terrible disaster in Eretz Israel in terms of physical disaster, right? Famine and illness and locusts, that we didn't have enough. There's a locust plague in 1915. And that Ottoman Turks were very cruel. But ultimately, it ends with the British conquering Palestine and this new hope that things are going to be different. Of course, fed by the fact that right before the conquest, we have the Balfour Declaration. Okay? Herbert Samuel becomes the first High Commissioner of Palestine. And in those years of the 20s and 30s, Arab nationalism growing, Jewish self-defense growing, right? The Haganah founded in 1920, the Irgun in 1931, Arab revolt from 36 to 39. And we're going to finish up with the Peel Commission, with the British attempt to partition, which doesn't actually happen. And that's going to be our lead into next time when we're going to talk about the War of Independence. So that's just to give us a kind of a bigger picture. So Theodor Herzl, an unlikely Zionist hero. Why is he unlikely? Because he comes from a very assimilated family, born in Budapest in Hungary, goes to Vienna, which is, of course, the hub of everything that's happening in late 19th century Europe. Not particularly interested in his Judaism, but of course, his Judaism affects him because despite the fact that here we are in Western Europe and the Enlightenment and everything's opening up to Jews, everything's not opening up to Jews. There are quotas, and besides the quotas, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, both under the surface and above the surface. Herzl wants to be a playwright. He's not so good at it. He becomes a journalist instead. He gets this very plum assignment. He gets sent to Paris for a newspaper, a Viennese newspaper called the Neue Freie Presse. He comes to Paris for the story of the decade, right? What's the story of the decade? That's the picture that you have here on the right. That's the story of Alfred Dreyfus, right? The Dreyfus trial. Why is the Dreyfus trial such a big deal? So Alfred Dreyfus, also very assimilated secular Jew, a French Jew who serves in the French army and seems to have reached the epitome of what French Jews are supposed to reach, meaning they were emancipated by Napoleon. They're part of regular society. They are citizens of the Republic. They can do anything and they can go into the army and reach high rank. But that doesn't mean that there isn't anti-Semitism. And Dreyfus, his colleagues, his anti-Semitic colleagues, are very jealous of his accomplishments, and they frame him. They frame him for treason, say that he's a spy for the Germans. But of course, the undercurrent is Jews, as much as they proclaim their loyalty, can never really be loyal citizens of their country. There's always a dual loyalty, right? It's a charge that we're still dealing with today. And the fact that they accuse him of treason, that's not such a huge story. That's not so crazy. Jealousy in the ranks, they want to get rid. What the huge story is when you get to the courthouse, when Herzl the reporter arrives at the courthouse, there's a massive mob outside. Death to the Jews. Jews are traitors. And suddenly for Herzl, as we say in Hebrew, ha'asimon nafal, the penny drops. He's like, wait a second, I always thought that Jews could be part of this new world, this new emancipated world. It's not true. I see that it's not true. And this provokes a whole crisis, which leads him to write the Jewish state, their Judenstaat, right? The Jewish state, this pamphlet that he writes where he talks about the sickness of anti-Semitism in Europe. Now realize this is 1895. This is not news, right? Leo Pinsker, as people who came last time, wrote about this a decade and a half before. But Herzl somehow manages to capture people's imagination by writing about how there's never going to be peace and safety for the Jews in Europe. And therefore, we have to go and we have to create our own state. Now, what's the goal behind it? What does he want to do? First of all, take a look at this middle picture. It's a great picture. I hope you can see Herzl hiding here in the middle. Right, there he is. on the podium speaking. Okay, this is in Basel, Switzerland. This is the first Zionist Congress, 1897, gathering of Jewish delegates from all over. Okay, not huge numbers in the beginning, only a few hundred, but every year he gets more and more people. Now, what's the idea behind it? The idea behind it was, number one, to really get the people involved. This is not a small movement. These are not small societies, these little lovers of Zion societies, and 10 Jews and 20 Jews and 50 Jews going to make a moshava somewhere. This is to take the entire Jewish nation from all over and to bring them together to create Jewish institutions, right? And they come up with all kinds of brilliant ideas, a bank, a national anthem, a new university, a committee that's going to oversee everything, right? So it's a much more organized, much less of a kind of grassroots, one person here, one person there. And in that way, in that sense, he's very successful. Where he's less successful is in his approach. And what is his approach? And we call it political Zionism. Let me go to various world rulers, and he goes to everybody. He goes to everybody from the Tsar to the Kaiser to the British Prime Minister, to the Ottoman Sultan, and he wants to get a charter. That's what he wants. I want a charter to create a Jewish state in Palestine. Now, this approach fails. It totally fails. But the approach of gathering everyone together, galvanizing them, bringing Jews from all over, that is really an incredible thing. And at the end of the first Zionist Congress, right, he holds it in Basel, Switzerland. Like we said, people come from all over. He makes sure it's very impressive, right? He puts it in this huge hall, and he wears formal dress. And everything is meant to be not this bedraggled shtetl people, but real people. And it didn't hurt, by the way, that Herzl looks the way he does. Okay, let's look back at him for a second. Herzl is a very impressive looking man. Okay, he looks the part. He's playing the part of King of the Jews, and people are impressed by that. And it really is a radical departure. At the end of the first Zionist Congress, he goes home, he writes in his diary, in Basel, I founded the Jewish state. He has a healthy ego as well, right? And he says, maybe not in 5 years, but certainly in 50 years, there will be a Jewish state. And he writes this in 1897, right? 51 years later, we have a Jewish state. Now, he also, like I said, he's looking around for charters from everywhere. And at a certain point, well, first of all, let's look at this book for a second, right? Alt-Neuland over here. Alt-Neuland, old new land, which is what Tel Aviv is named for, by the way. Tel Aviv is the old new land. Tel is old, Aviv is new. He writes this novel, right? The Jewish State is a very serious political pamphlet laying out his ideas. Alt-Neuland is a novel, Roman, okay, as you can see here. And it's this kind of interesting, a little bit loopy, utopian view of, you know, here's this hair, I don't even remember, here, somebody who comes on the boat 50 years later and he sees the Jewish state. And what is he seeing? Of course, it's a model of progress and industry and European culture. It's not so much Jewish, right? There are synagogues, but it is nothing like what he envisioned today's Jewish state. But it's a fascinating thing to read. If you've ever been in Jerusalem, there's the Herzl Museum, which was made by the Jewish Agency in 2004 for 100 years to Herzl's death. And they have this great movie there, I really like it, where they contrast Herzl's vision of Alt-Neuland, that's part of it, with what Israel really is today. Okay? Now, he comes to Palestine in 1898. This is a picture of him in Jerusalem at the Stern House in Manila. For him, the most important encounter that he has in all his various encounters in Eretz Israel is with Kaiser Wilhelm, who's also in Jerusalem, also in the land of Israel in 1898. Kaiser Wilhelm is there because he wants to ally with the Ottoman Empire to rule the world. Herzl figures Kaiser Wilhelm is there, I'm there too. I can convince him to support the Zionist idea. Really very deluded. he has a meeting with Kaiser Wilhelm at Mikveh Yisrael, and again in Jerusalem, where basically he pours out his heart and the Kaiser says, yes, the land needs lots of water. And Herzl says, well, we're going to need a great deal of money. And he says, well, you Jews have all the money. That's basically the conversation. It doesn't further the Zionist cause at all, but for Herzl, it's a very big deal. Now, the story of Uganda, we'll just address it very briefly because it's a whole story in and of itself. When he goes to the British Foreign Minister in his making the rounds of everybody, they offer him this place in East Africa. Well, you can have your little Jewish state here because, you know, we have this property and you can use it and that's fine. And Herzl is elated and he goes to the Congress with this proposal and they throw it back in his face. Well, what do you mean, Uganda? We want to go to Jerusalem. We want to go to Eretz Israel. This is what the Jews have been dreaming about for millennia. What kind of a crazy idea is this to go to Uganda? And Herzl says to them, not unreasonably, we need to get the Jews out. This is a burning house. We need to get the Jews out of the burning house and save their lives. And then we'll move on to Eretz Israel, which is really not a crazy idea. And it's interesting to wonder what might have happened if the Uganda proposal had been taken. And Herzl is very, he might have been deluded about the idea of charters and international cooperation, but he's very clear-eyed about anti-Semitism and the potential for anti-Semitism in Europe. I won't say he predicted the Holocaust, but he knew that good things were not coming. But the Zionist Congress is bitterly, bitterly divided over this. And Herzl, essentially heartbroken, dies at 44, dies a year later. There's a novel that was written a few years ago called Altneuland, imagining this alternate reality of what would have happened if we had created a state in Uganda in 1903. Herzl is buried in Vienna, but he writes in his will that when it's possible, he wants to be brought, not if, but when he wants to be brought to the state of Israel, which is of course what you see in the picture here on the right, in 1949. One of the first acts Israel does when the War of Independence is over is bring Herzl's remains from Vienna to a mountain in the west of Jerusalem that is then renamed Mount Herzl and becomes the place, the pantheon for the great leaders, only some of them, as well as a military cemetery, and Yad Vashem is built there next door 4 years later. So that's what happens to Herzl and where he ends up. And today, of course, that's where the big ceremony, the beginning of Independence Day. So it's a significant place. Meanwhile, what's going on with the Ottoman Empire? And the Ottoman Empire at this point is known as the sick man of Europe. Everybody knows it's going to fall apart. And everybody is waiting, right? It's kind of horrific, right? The vultures circling around, waiting for the Ottoman Empire to fall apart so that they can step in. We would feel bad, except that the Ottoman Empire is, we're terrible people at this stage. So we don't feel that bad. Now, in preparation for this plus with certain religious feelings and missionary feelings, the great powers of Europe, and ultimately the United States as well, established themselves in Jerusalem. And late 19th, early 20th century is when everybody builds some monument, some institution in Jerusalem. I brought a few of them for you here. There's the Russian compound on the left. Okay? In the middle is the missionary hospital of the London Society for Promoting Christianity Amongst the Jews, not very subtle, okay? The missionary society that that comes and wants to convert the Jews. And on the right is Schmidt College, is what the German Catholics built. We also have Notre Dame of the French. We have the Italian hospital. Even the Americans chime in and build the YMCA, right? That's after the Ottoman Empire is gone already. But everybody's kind of waiting for this moment to happen. And the Jews are waiting as well. Now, meanwhile, right, we're going to keep cutting back and forth between the other powers and what's happening internally. Okay. Meanwhile, we have the beginnings of, I'll call it linguistic Zionism, for lack of a better word. Here, of course, is Eliezer ben Yehuda poring over his books. Eliezer ben Yehuda comes early, right? He comes to the land of Israel already in 1881, and he comes with a very specific goal in mind. Already on the ship, he says to his wife, "When we get to Palestine, we are speaking only Ivrit." And she, you know, she's a good wife and she agrees, but this is a little bit of a crazy demand because there are very few practical modern words. Hebrew never dies, right? Hebrew remains a living language to the extent that people prayed in it, people studied in it, people wrote poetry and literature in it. But if Eliezer wanted to say to Deborah, "Please go to the supermarket and buy me a kilo of tomatoes, some coffee, and a package of chocolate," he can't say any of those things because those words do not exist. Hebrew has not developed into the modern world. But that doesn't matter to Eliezer ben Yehuda because he says, it's all very nice to have political Zionism and settlement and moshavot, but without a common language, we cannot talk to each other. We cannot survive. And here you have Jews who are speaking Russian and German and Yiddish and Polish and Ladino and Arabic, and we need to find a common language. And he comes with this bee in his bonnet, and he starts, not alone, there are others who work with him, but he starts to compile a monumental dictionary where he doesn't make up words, right? He uses, and this is why you see him with all the books, he uses roots and words from the enormous corpus of Hebrew literature. So I'll just give you an example or two that I really love. The best example, I think, is the word for electricity. Right? Electricity, clearly a modern word, not in the Bible. What's electricity? Chashmal. It's a biblical word. It comes from the book of Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel, who has these crazy, trippy visions. And in the first one, the Maaseh Merkabah, right, the vision of the chariot, he sees Me'ein Chashmal, this bright, shining light. Oh, it's a good word for electricity, right? There are others that are simpler, Rakevet, a train, from Merkava, a chariot, right? Yeah, a lot of words like that. People write him, they ask him questions, school children write him, they say, we have this break in the middle of the morning where we're supposed to eat our sandwiches, what should we call that? And he says, hafsaka, lehafsik, to stop, make a break, right? My favorite one is the word for tomato. Tomatoes, of course, come from the New World. They do not exist in the time of Tanakh or Mishnah or anything else. What's a tomato? A tomato is an agvania. Agvania, perfectly normal word, go to the supermarket, say it, tell people you're putting it in a salad, nobody's upset. But when Eliezer ben Yehuda coined the word, people refused to use it because agvania comes from the root la'agov or ogev, which means lust. And people thought tomatoes were aphrodisiacs. They were called love apples. And they didn't want to use that word. Not such a nice word. Okay. Now, Eliezer ben Yehuda chips away at this. He has enemies. The Ottoman Turks don't like him. The ultra-Orthodox don't like him. Here you are taking this sacred language and using it for secular pursuits. But yet it works. And within a generation, school is being taught in Hebrew. Okay, here's the Gymnasia Herzliya on the right here. This is the Hebrew High School of Tel Aviv. School is being taught in Hebrew. Newspapers are being published in Hebrew. People are walking down the street speaking Hebrew. So Eliezer ben Yehuda is really an unbelievable pioneer. However, the war is not completely won. The struggle is not completely won. We have this fascinating little blip of history in 1913. Where the German help society, the Hilfsverein, called the Ezra, helps to create the first university in Eretz Israel. We often think it's Hebrew University. It's not. It's the Technion in Haifa, the scientific university, which was not called the Technion. It was called the Technikum, which, of course, is German. And German was the language of science. Just like today, English is the language of science. And in 10 years, Chinese will be the language of science. In the early part of the 20th century, German is the language of science. And the founders of the Technikum said, well, of course, the language of instruction is going to be German. They are German Jews. And the language of instruction is German. And of course, we don't have the terrible associations of German that we have post-World War II. And they say that that's what we are conditioning this university on. And all hell breaks loose. Protests, strikes, people resign from the Ezra Seminary, right? David Yalin, who is in the Ezra Teacher Seminary, resigns and creates his own, the David Yalin Teacher Seminary. Chasya Sukanik, who is the preschool teacher in the land of Israel, she resigns from the Ezra preschool and creates her own. People go out and protest. You can see the signs. There's some great signs, right? So take a look at this one on the left here. Asefa Pumbik Dola, large public assembly. Where is it going to be? Hanosei Asefa Ivrit Sfat HaLimud Bate Sefer Ivriya Be'eretz Israel. The subject, the Hebrew language, which should be the language of teaching, of education in the Hebrew schools of the land of Israel. And of course, Eliezer ben Yehuda joins in. And this is mass protest. And finally, the Ezra backs down. And that's what you can see here in this. There's a lot of interesting posters. If you're into this, you can look on the National Library of Israel. They have all these interesting materials. And here we go. Layudim Shir HaNitzachon, the victory song. Heydad, heydad, giborim. Talmidim umorim, nitzchas batenu. Hey, hooray, hooray, our heroes, the students and the teachers, our language has won. Okay? And going on and talking about it now, it's not just it's not just a technical thing, not to, no pun intended. It's about creating a new cultural identity. We are not just part of Europe. We are part of our own something new that we are creating with this ancient language, taking from the past, going into the future. And it's a very powerful moment. Now, this doesn't mean that, and it's talking about what is going to be the character of this state in the making. That doesn't mean that people didn't laugh at it. One of the texts that was written at this time was a parody of a Gemara, right? That's a time-honored spoof called Baba Technica. And it starts by saying, Shnaim Ochazim, which is, of course, the very famous beginning of Baba Kama, two are holding. Ivrit v'Germanit, Hebrew and German, right? So these are the two languages. And today, of course, the language war is still going on, only it's not German anymore, but it's rather it's English. But this is a formative moment. Now, again, culturally, what's going on? Art. Language is not the only thing. There's also art. And you have this rather curious figure, the fellow in the long robes here, Boris Schatz, who's an artist, who's a sculptor, who already early on at one of the Zionist congresses proposes to Theodor Herzl a Jewish art school, the first Jewish artists since the time of the temple, right? That's how he phrases it. And Herzl is pro, but there's no money, right? But Boris Schatz manages to come to the land of Israel, manages to get some money, manages to buy a piece of property today in the center of downtown Jerusalem, right off of King George Street. And he creates what he calls the Bezalel School. Why Bezalel? Who's Bezalel? Bezalel is the artist, the architect of the tabernacle, of the Mishkan. And he's very into Bezalel. He names his son Bezalel, right? And he sees his school as a direct connection between Bezalel and the artistry of the temple, right, and the tabernacle and the temple and the future artistry. Now, this doesn't stop him from advocating things like free love, and he's a very free thinker, but he definitely is always harking back to Tanakh, and you can even see, right, look at how he decorates his house, Beit Schatz. Hey, he's got the cherubs who are at the entrance to the Garden of Eden. He's got Bezalel here working on the Mishkan. Many of his things are very, very biblically inspired. He also wants to go back to old crafts, right? He brings Yemenites, silversmiths, and woodworkers. He doesn't treat them so nicely, right? But this idea of going back to the past. Now, Bezalel still exists today as an art school. My daughter actually is in it. It is very postmodern. It is not following at all in the footsteps of Schatz, but in those early years, Bezalel was a very formative part of the art of the land of Israel. And I'm sure a lot of you have seen these great posters. You see them in the Arab Shuk sometimes. Come to Palestine, right? With these camels and biblical vistas and looking very, very biblical. Come to Palestine, of course, was Jews saying, come to Palestine, right? When it was Palestine. Now you see it in the Shuk and it's Arabs saying, come to Palestine, as in the Palestinian Authority. And a whole school of artists who created art about biblical characters. Their models, by the way, are often Arabs, local Arabs, who they believe look like the characters of the Bible, right? Fascinating. Now, Boris Schatz wants approval. He wants this to be a Jewish art school. So he goes to the leading Jew of the time. And that, of course, is Rav Kook, who we mentioned a little bit last time. And Rav Kook is fascinating because, of course, he is an extremely Orthodox man, as you can see, but he's also a revolutionary. And as much as he's a Hasid and he's a scholar and he knows tons of Torah, he wants a radical revolution of Judaism. And last time we read the quote from Hador, The Generation, where he talks about the wondrousness of this generation that grew up in religion and is now rejecting it for all kinds of new ideas, right? They want to make the world a better place, socialism and labor Zionism. And he says, I want that fire in Judaism. And this is another of his great writings, right? He says, I walk around with an overwhelming jealousy of the secular world. It is a jealousy that consumes me. For is it really possible that the power of creativity has ceased within the religious world? There is no one who is willing to explain, expand, and help the world appreciate these holy ideas, nor is there anyone who is striving to help actualize them into practical deeds. And this concerning all this, I became sick and suffered great pains of the soul. These are my sufferings of love that caused me to call out in a great voice to proclaim a spiritual revolution. And these ideas are still very much in the world today, certainly in Israeli Judaism, which the youth certainly are always looking in a new way and a spiritual way. And it's a beautiful continuation of Rav Kook. But while adhering to halakha, right, to Jewish law. And that's a very fine line to tread. What's his response to Boris Schatz when he says, "Will you approve Bezalel?" He tells a story. He says, there's a little girl who is very, very ill, and her parents are very upset, and they're praying, and they take care of her. And one morning, she wakes up, and she asks for her doll, and the parents are overjoyed. Why? Because if you can ask for a doll and not just to eat, to sleep, to take your medicine, then clearly you have reached a point where you're feeling better. And he says the Jewish people have reached that point. We're not only surviving, but we are ready for creativity again. And he approves of Bezalel with very strong caveats, okay? Without human imagery, without anything that's, you know, not respectful to Judaism, which of course art doesn't really work that way. So Rav Kook and Bezalel ultimately part ways. Now, Rav Kook and Boris Schatz are part of this dynamic, what we call the Second Aliyah, right? 1904 to 1914. It's relatively short, but it is very, very formative in terms of the people who come. When the first Aliyah was mostly families, middle class, they want to farm, they want to work the land, they want to be here in a Jewish homeland, but they're not radicals. The Second Aliyah is a lot of young people, right? A lot of young people who came from religious home, turned aside, decided they wanted to be part of the revolution, but they're not going to be in the revolution in Russia, right? Or in other places. They want the revolution to be here in Eretz Israel. Socialism is very important to many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And they create unbelievable new institutions, healthcare, Kupat Cholim, the kibbutz, the first Jewish self-defense organizations, and the first beginnings of a real political structure in the land of Israel. So here are three of the very prominent Second Aliyah personalities. I wonder how many people recognize the person on the right without his shock of white hair. This is David Ben-Gurion. Young David Ben-Gurion in his Jewish legion, you know, fighting for the British Army uniform, right, comes here. And like all these guys, he starts out by working on a farm, right, agricultural labor, but very soon, becomes more of a politician. And he goes together with his colleague, Yitzhak Ben Zvi, who's this fellow with the classy Turkish hat. They actually go to Istanbul to study law, so that they can become, you know, versed in law and use that for the Zionist cause. The couple, Yitzhak Ben Zvi, is with Rachel Yanait Ben Zvi. They eventually get married. They start out just kind of shacking up. They're very unconventional in many ways. And she is just as incredible as him. He eventually becomes the second president of Israel, but that's after his very long and very distinguished career in building up the Jewish state, in creating HaShomer, the Jewish Defense Organization. She, meanwhile, is involved in agricultural training school, in a youth village. They are a real power couple, and they are both very, very vibrant, very fiery socialists. Socialism is almost as important as Zionism to them. Now, 1909, we have the beginnings of something that is a very, very significant event in the history of Eretz Israel, and that's the beginnings of Jewish self-defense. Up until this point, basically the Jewish moshavot, right, the farming communities, hired Arab guards to guard from against thievery or anything else, and at a certain point, the Jews said, well, maybe we should start doing this ourselves. And they're realizing that they don't always see eye to eye with the Arabs, and they might be defending themselves against the Arabs. And so they create, first there's a secret, a clandestine group called Bar Giora, and it grows into something a little bit more formal called HaShomer, the Watchman. And the idea is to create a corps of Jewish guards who will guard all of the Yishuvim. Now, if you look at them, take a look at these guys over here on the left, they look like Arabs. They're trying to look like Arabs. They learn to ride horses like Arabs. They also have a little bit of inspiration from the Cossacks, weird as that sounds. But they feel that they are connecting to the land. They're returning to the land. They're dressing like Arabs. And this is how they are going to really authentically be part of the land of Israel and defend it and protect it. Now, this is started by the Ben Zvis, by a couple called Yisrael and Manya Shochat, by Yisrael Giladi. Kfar Giladi in the north is named after Yisrael Giladi, and that's where you have the cemetery of the Shomer, and that's where you have this memorial to them, and see what their slogan is. B'dam ve'esh yudan nafla, B'dam ve'esh yudatakum, something we actually read on Tisha B'Av. In blood and fire, Judah fell. In blood and fire, Judah will stand again. So they are not afraid to fight, but they do teach moderation. They say, don't use your gun unless absolutely necessary. It's meant just to show that you're a powerful figure. In 1920, the Shomer becomes, or is basically disbanded, and a new organization is founded, but a lot of the same people, the Haganah, right? The Haganah, which ultimately becomes the IDF. So the Shomer is really the precursor of the IDF. The fellow on the horse on the right is one of the Shomer members named Alexander Zaid, and he still is involved, even after the Shomer is officially disbanded, he's involved in protecting Jewish communities, and he goes to protect the...
Yes, sir.
The small community
well, hang on,
of
hang on, I'm just
hang mute on a yourself, minute. Please, or Rabbi Kalman, no, mute this person, please. He goes to protect the small community of Beit She'arim, the communities nearby, the area called Sheikh Abrech, and he's murdered by an Arab, and that's why his statue is there in Beit She'arim. Meanwhile, the most important event in this whole time period begins, and that's World War I. Now, in World War I, of course, the Ottoman Empire is going to fall, but nobody knows that yet. Now, most of the Jews are terrified of the Ottomans. The Ottoman Turks, first of all, the Armenian genocide has just happened, or is in the process of happening. And if the Jews needed any more proof of the cruelty of the Turks, the Armenian genocide is definitely there. And they just want to stay out of the Ottomans' way. Most of the Yishuv, they don't want to make trouble because who knows the way the winds are going to blow. But there's a very small and very courageous group, which at the time was completely cast out by the Yishuv. It took a very long time for them to be acknowledged for their heroism. And that's Nili, Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker. The Aronson family in Zichron Yaakov, along with a few other people, Avshalom Feinberg, Yosef Lushansky, they form a spy ring where they spy on the Turks and provide the information to the British. The British don't 100% trust them in the beginning, but eventually they do, and the information proves to be incredibly important. We're only now realizing how much this information actually helped the British to win the war. The real heroine of the story is Sarah Aronson, because the others, somehow Avshalom Feinberg goes with Yosef Lushansky to Europe to Egypt, to deliver information to the British when their contacts with them are cut off. Aaron Aronson goes to Europe. Different people go in different places. Sarah stays and holds down the fort. And the eventual way that they use to transfer their information to the British is by carrier pigeons. Okay, and the terrible tragedy happens because one of the carrier pigeons is captured by the Turks, and a carrier pigeon is a homing pigeon.
Deborah, can you please mute yourself?
Maybe Rabbi Kalman, mute everybody.
I get there. Sometimes it takes me half a second, but I'm trying to be on top of anybody. Yeah, but please, everybody,
Thank
mute
you.
Themselves. Okay. Please do.
Meanwhile, the pigeon comes back, the Turks follow it, they find Sarah, they torture her to get her to give up the names of her comrades. She won't give up anybody's name, and they decide to take her to Damascus to torture her further. And she requests to be allowed to go home first, to change her dress, to take a bath. The Turks are very gentlemanly. They escort her to her house through the streets of Zichron Yaakov. If you want to read a fascinating book about how the people of Zichron Yaakov basically repudiated her. Hillel Halkin wrote a book about this a while ago. She comes to her house. They allow her to go by herself into the bathroom. What they don't know is that hidden in the bathroom is a slick. There's a secret compartment in the wall that holds a gun. And she shoots herself. Now, unfortunately, she doesn't do it right. And she actually stays alive for another few days until she finally dies in agony. It's a terrible, terrible story, but she doesn't give up the name of a single person. She doesn't give up the spy ring. And this is her grave in the Zichron Yaakov Cemetery. And Neely was really very significant in helping to bring down the Turks. Meanwhile, there are Jews, when the war is beginning to turn the tide a little bit, there are Jews who, A, want to help the British because they realize that the British is going to be better than the Turks. Anything will be better than the Turks. And B, they want to gain military experience. And so they push and push and push the British to allow a Jewish legion what originally has the name the Zion Mule Corps, right? They have Jewish soldiers who are going to fight in Eretz Israel and in other places nearby. One of the founders is this handsome gentleman over here on the left, Yosef Trumpeldor, who was a veteran from the Russian army, a true hero, Zionist hero as well. And in the middle, of course, is Zeev Jabotinsky, who we'll come back to, we'll talk about. He's wearing on his lapel the pigeon, the symbol, the pin that's the symbol of one of the divisions of the Jewish Legion, the Judea Legion. And they get the British to agree to create this Jewish corpus of soldiers. And it's led by the gentleman on the right, who's a fascinating fellow. This is John Henry Patterson, obviously not Jewish, a Christian Zionist, a true supporter of the Jews. He actually was friends with Netanyahu's father, with Ben Sion Netanyahu. He was eventually brought here and buried in Eretz Israel. He's most famous because he shoots lions in Kenya, lions that are attacking his work crew, but that's really not the reason that we are supportive of him. He really helped to create this Jewish Legion and was a consistent supporter of the Jews and of Zionism. Now, Jabotinsky is a fascinating person. He eventually comes to Eretz Israel. He's involved in the defense, the Jewish self-defense in the 1920s, and he's the creator of something called revisionist Zionism. Unlike Ben Gurion and Ben Zvi and the others around them, he is not a socialist. He is not a labor Zionist. He creates something new that is very based on Jewish pride, on militarism, and also on a more capitalistic view of the world. He comes up with a phrase that he calls the Iron Wall, which really informs the activities of the Irgun, which he's also behind, which is that if you show your enemies that you are intractable and you will show incredible force and the willingness to use force, ultimately they will negotiate with you. And that's one of the major ideas of Jabotinsky and of the Irgun. Needless to say, Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion were not buddies, although they do have a fascinating meeting in London before the state is created, long before Jabotinsky dies in 1940, to discuss how to bring their two groups together. And Jabotinsky's main student, main chassid, Menachem Begin, of course, does not get along with Ben-Gurion either. World War I, despite the fact that the British are going to win and bring a better world to the Jews, World War I is in and of itself a terrible, terrible period in Eretz Israel. Like we said, famine, illness, locusts. Okay, take a look at the picture on the right, on the left. I hope you can see it. This is locusts covering a tree, right? All that you see there, these are not leaves. These are arbeh. These are locusts. Okay, locust swarms do come to the land of Israel. We had one a few years ago. Today, we know how to get rid of them. Then they didn't know what to do. There was nothing they could do, right? The locusts would come. They would literally denude a tree in a few minutes. And then, of course, once their attack is finished and they're dying, they don't live so long, they're laying eggs, right? What's going to happen? So it really took away from the already very small food supply. Not only that, many Jews here were living off of money coming from Europe, and the Turks during the war don't allow anything to come from Europe. So you have even more troubles. And to top it all off, as the war is coming to a close in 1917, that's the picture here on the right, the Turks expel all the Jews from Tel Aviv and Jaffa, 8,000 people. Where are they going to go? Okay, some of them go to the Galilee, different places. 430 of them die. This is a monument for them in the Kinneret Cemetery in the north. So the Ottomans really went out in a way that showed their cruelty. And it was a very, very terrible time period. But the British do come in. The British do conquer, first coming up from the south, coming up from Egypt. Dramatic and courageous battle to take Beersheba. And this is taken by the Anzac troops, the Australian and New Zealand Armored Corps. And it's one of the final light horse battles, right? And that's the monument that you see here and the reenactment that they do every 10 years or so. They've been doing, they did 2017 and 2007 down in Beersheba. The reason that the horses charge Beersheba is because they needed water. They were desperate for water, and there were wells in Beersheba, and they charged the Arabs in the town, and they managed to conquer it in that way. So they take Beersheba, they move on towards Jerusalem, General Allenby here in the middle. And then we have this crazy story where Jerusalem surrenders four times. Okay? They get to Jerusalem December 1917, and the local Arabs of Jerusalem, the mayor of Jerusalem, they realize that this is not happening. Beersheba has been taken. The British are clearly going to win. They don't want any terrible consequences, and they decide to surrender. Well, they do it in rather an odd way. Okay? So on the morning of December 9th, I believe, okay, there are two cooks, British Army cooks, who go out to try and find some eggs to serve up to their soldiers. And the mayor of Jerusalem and a whole delegation along with them comes across them and says, "We surrender. Here's our white flag." And the cooks are a little bit bemused. "Really, you're surrendering to us? We're cooks." And they take them back to the camp, to the generals in the camp, General Watson. And he says, "You want to surrender? You got to surrender to me." So they say, "Okay, we surrender." And then General Allenby, of course, who's the leader of the troops, comes along and says, "I'm sorry, but your surrenders were really not very worthwhile. You need to surrender to me." So they surrender a third time. And then they do an official handing over of power at the Jaffa Gate a couple of days later. So there is no question that, at least in Jerusalem, the Ottoman Turks surrendered to the British. And the British come in. Now, the British, the legacy of the British in Jerusalem, in other places as well, but in Jerusalem particularly, is fascinating. First of all, like in other places where the British army served and fell, there are military cemeteries. In Jerusalem is the main one, but there are another four in the different parts of the country, Beersheba, Ramla, Haifa, I'm forgetting the last one. And besides the military cemetery, you have a monument, right? You have a monument, which is at the entrance to Jerusalem today in Romema. Take a look at this monument. It's a fascinating thing. It's supposed to look like other monuments around the British Empire. If you've seen the cenotaph in London, that's what this is, right? But it has something a little bit different, right? The Holy City was surrendered. But take a look at these guys, right? Take a look at the figures on the cenotaph, which you have in Jerusalem. You do not have in other places. And you cannot escape the realization that these guys look like crusaders, okay? As much as the British may not have thought this was necessarily a crusade, Christians conquering Muslims in Jerusalem, the artist of the monument definitely thought of it as a crusade and of the last crusade. Here we are, we have finally come back. Allenby is careful not to use those words, but he receives the keys to the city from the Muslims, and there's very much this feeling of, well, the Crusades have ended and we have returned. Now, the Jews are very hopeful because of a few things, one of which, of course, is the Balfour Declaration. Okay? A month before the surrender of Jerusalem, November 2nd, 1917, Lord Balfour writes an official letter to Lord Rothschild, very, very famous. "I have much pleasure in conveying on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration with Jewish Zionist aspirations. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people." Okay, it being clearly understood that nothing will prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Most Jews stop reading after the first sentence, but the rest of the sentences are important as well. This is very limited. It's not all of Palestine. It doesn't necessarily even talk about a government and sovereignty. It talks about a national home. But still, it is the first expression of this charter that Herzl had been asking for. This is the first time we have a country that's saying, "We will acknowledge, we will help you to establish a national home." And this, of course, is accomplished by a lot of Zionist pressure. It's also accomplished by the untrue but widespread belief that Jews are very powerful. And here we are still in the heat of World War I in 1917. And the British government believes, incorrectly, that the Jews will influence the Americans in the war. They will influence the Russians, right? The Jews are going to do everything. So this is going to help us in the war. But we also have this gentleman in the middle here. And this is Chaim Weizmann, who's chiefly known as the first president of Israel, but he had a very long and storied career in the Zionist world before that. And his presidency kind of goes out with a whimper and not with a bang, because he doesn't really have any influence as president, but he's very important before that. Now, Weizmann was a chemist. That was his profession. And he is in England during the war, and he invents something very important, okay, called synthetic acetone, which is very useful in creating explosives. Okay, they need to have materials to create explosives. Weizmann creates something that doesn't need to be imported from anywhere else, and it's very significant to the war effort. And he's offered a knighthood, and he says, "I don't want a knighthood. I want a declaration that you are going to help establish a national home for the Jewish people." And that's one of the reasons why the Balfour Declaration is written. Now, the Balfour Declaration is huge, right? It's a really, really big deal. And you can see in this is the tombstone of Eliezer ben Yehuda. Okay, take a look at what it says on his tombstone. Eliezer ben Yehuda, Mechayei HaLashon HaIvrit, Mechaber HaMilon HaGadol, Niftar B'Yerushalayim, right? The reviver of the Hebrew language, the author of the great dictionary, right? Niftar B'Yerushalayim, he dies in Jerusalem, Hashishim B'Chamesh L'Mechayav, he's 65 years old. Look at the date. Kafchet Kislev, right? Kavav Kislev, Vav Lehatzarat Balfour. Doesn't have the Hebrew date. It doesn't have the English date. 6 years to the Balfour Declaration. That's how they write the date. And there are people who are named, their babies who are named Balfour, Balfouria. Hey, it's a very big deal. Now, that is added to by the fact that the new High Commissioner of Palestine is a Jew, whose name is Herbert Samuel. And not only a Jew, he's a relatively traditional Jew. He knows some things, right? And he comes, what could be a stronger beginning of the redemption than here is a Jew who is going to rule over all of Eretz Israel. And in fact, to welcome him on the first Shabbat that he's here, which is Shabbat Nachamu, okay, the first Shabbat is after Tisha B'Av, where we read Nachamu Nachamu Ami, comfort my people. He is invited to the main Ashkenazi synagogue of Jerusalem, the Chorva synagogue. And in the middle here, you have an invitation. This is an invitation actually for a very important personage, Rav Chaim Zonnenfeld, inviting him to pray in the synagogue with the Netziv HaElyon, Nesi Artzeinu HaKdosha, the president of our holy country. And he's called up to the Haftorah of Nachamu Nachamu Ami. People see this as a true messianic moment. Does that really happen? Not so much. Before we get to the bad stuff about the British, let's talk for a minute about the good stuff, because the British do leave a strong positive legacy in Eretz Israel as well. Their limiting of immigration and settlement is disastrous, and many people die because of it, but we'll get to that. Don't worry. Let's talk about the positive for just a moment. They come into a land that the Ottoman Turks have essentially neglected for about a century, and they start to build and they start to clean up, literally sewage, plumbing, urban planning. Okay? Some of their major buildings in Jerusalem, definitely, they build the High Commissioner's Palace. That's the building here on the right. Today it's the UN headquarters in southern Jerusalem on the promenade. They build this as the palace for the High Commissioner, a very impressive building. They build the first archaeology museum in Palestine, the Rockefeller Museum, and that's what you see here on the left. Both of these beautiful, beautiful buildings, which are still around today, created by a very interesting architect named Austin St. Barbie Harrison, very British, as you can see from his name, but in love with the Middle East and with Greece, and he lives here his whole career here in Greece. They bring in water, okay? The water situation. People are still drinking out of cisterns. They bring water pipes and a pumping station from Wadi Kelt to the east of us. They create actual sewage, garbage disposal. They get rid of the brothels. There are brothels and whores all over Jerusalem. They get rid of them. And they bring in the idea of urban planning. And they bring in an urban planner named Patrick Geddes, who plans out Jerusalem, the new neighborhoods, green areas, right? This is the urban planning, which doesn't really happen in Jerusalem. He plans out Tel Aviv, where it does, to a certain extent, happen. They're involved in art and archaeology. They bring in the Armenians to create what we think of as this ancient craft. It is an ancient craft, but not in Jerusalem. the Armenian craftsmen and come in to create the Armenian tiles. They're really brought in to work on, to renovate the Dome of the Rock. In the end, it doesn't happen, but they do other things like the Armenian tiles in the Rockefeller Museum, which is what you see here. Archaeology, right? Archaeologists digging up sites like Beit She'an. This Ramses statue is from Beit She'an. And with this vision of harmony among all the various peoples. And in the Rockefeller Museum is where that really comes to fruition. They put in displays of Jewish life in the land of Israel, Christian, Muslim. These in the middle here, these are panels from the Al-Aqsa Mosque, right, on the Temple Mount, which the Arabs give to them because they're renovating. It's hard to imagine such a thing happening today. There's a real belief that things will become harmonious, but also law and order, because, you know, we have to create some security and no fighting between the Jews and the Arabs. So they have these pillboxes, these guard towers, which today have been repainted around Jerusalem. This is a great one. Jails, of course, they take over the Ottoman prison in Akko. They build a new prison in the Russian compound in Jerusalem, as well as in Latrun and other places. That's what you see over here on the right. This is in Jerusalem. Separating the Jews and the Arabs. This is the massive staircase and spot to separate the Jewish quarter and the Arab quarter, so there won't be conflict between them. And there's a lot of hope in the beginning. And meanwhile, the Jews use this time to build things up, right? To build up their national institutions. Here are the buildings, the national buildings, the Jewish Agency building and the JNF building on King George Street, right? They moved the national institutions to Jerusalem from Jaffa because the British also established their headquarters in Jerusalem. They create the Hebrew University, Hadassah Hospital, buying up land. Right? This is the grave of Yehoshua and Olga Chaimkin, who are the crazy visionaries who pushed to buy the land of the Jezreel Valley, which is swamps and malaria and mosquitoes, and everybody thinks they're crazy. And in the end, this is Israel's Louisiana Purchase. This becomes such important land ownership, right? Banking, creating a national bank, the Anglo-Palestine Bank, which eventually becomes Bank Leumi, to buy land, to promote industry and infrastructure, even creating electrical power plants. That's the picture here on the right. Engineer from Russia, revolutionary, Pinchas Rutenberg, who among all the many other things he did, which include being involved in both Russian revolutions, he creates the first electrical power plant in a place called Naharaim by the Jordan River. So a lot is growing and building and developing on the Jewish side, including more and more and more Jews coming. So just take a look at these numbers for a minute. They're just fascinating numbers. If you look at the immigration numbers from the 1920s until 1945, you can see a steady, and at some points like real jumps, increase in Jewish immigration, whereas Christian immigration and Arab and Muslim immigration stays pretty stagnant. Hey, big jumps in, of course, 1933. Hitler rises to power, 1934, 1935. Right, numbers going up, and then huge drop, right? Because we're going to see the British create what's called the White Paper, where they limit severely Jewish immigration. Take a look at the percentages. In 1922, the Jews are 11% of the population. In 1931, they're 17%. And in 1945, they're 31%, right? So Jewish population steadily growing, Jewish land ownership steadily growing. All of this creates a backlash, which perhaps would have happened anyway, right? Arabs feel threatened. They begin to protest. We were here first. We are the majority in this country. We do not want all these Jews coming in and all of this land purchase. And one of the most rabid anti-Zionists and anti-Semites is this fellow here on the right, and that's Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti, the religious leader of Jerusalem. You can see him at this Arab protest meeting in 1929. He's behind, he incites the riots in 1920, the Nebi Musa riots, the terrible, terrible riots in 1929. He rejects partition, right? This push for Arab nationalism with no recognition of there being any possibility for Jewish nationalism, which of course leads to terrible riots. 1921 in Jaffa and the Moshavot. This is a common grave in the Trumpeldor Cemetery in Tel Aviv for the riots of 1921. And then, of course, the riots of 1929, which are terribly famous all over, largely because of the terrible massacre in Hebron. But there were also riots in Jerusalem, in Tzfat, in all different places. In response, the High Commissioner at this point is someone named John Chancellor, writes a strongly worded proclamation about how terrible this is, and they have to put a stop to this, and the Jews are not so terrible. But the Arabs claim, no, the Jews incited because of what they do at the Kotel, and they are too loud, and they are too aggressive, and they're taking over this holy place, which really belongs to us. And the British, in return, right, increase restrictions, both at the Kotel and at other places. I think the chauffeur blower story I'm going to save for next time, but I just want to do one more thing. Remind me, we'll come back to the chauffeur blowers. The British increased restrictions and culminating in the White Paper of 1939, which severely, severely limits Jewish immigration at a time where it couldn't be more necessary, and severely limits Jewish land purchase and settlement. What do the Jews do in response? Illegal immigration and semi-legal settlement building, right? Ha'apalar, Aliyah Bet, bringing in ships. Doesn't happen so much during World War II because it's too difficult, but after World War II, we're going to see, becomes very, very important. And building settlements that are called Tower and Stockade, Homa u'Migdal. The old Turkish law says that if you put up a wall, you put up a tower, that's it. You can't take it down anymore. And so they would put up these overnight settlements, and the Jews created more and more. But ultimately, the British see the need to partition, okay, to break up the land. We'll come back to the underground movement later, sorry. They come up with the Peel Commission plan in 1937 to partition the country. We're gonna come back to this, to be continued, okay, to be continued. Let's take a look at questions. Let's see, ooh, lots of questions, lots of comments. All right, let's go back to the beginning. Martin Gilbert says the yeshiva was viable as a state by the mid to late 30s, perhaps, right? And that's there's a fascinating historical novel, not historical novel, you know, one of those what if novels by Yehuda Avner about what would have happened if the Peel Commission had really happened and there was a Jewish state in 1937. No sources today. First session is recorded is on the site, I believe, right? Only pictures. Okay, the very important Sam Remo comments is true. There are many things missing from the timeline. I would agree. Are there other things like the Zionist conference by other disposed ethnic groups? Interesting. I mean, we talked last time about nationalism all over Europe. Is there such a thing as a conference? I would say, I don't know, but I would say not, only because only the Jews are scattered everywhere, right? The Jews are in all countries all over. Everybody else has a country. Their country may not have been viable at the time, but they are not all over the place. Okay, I don't know. Times of Israel book. Herzl, of course, is fallible. Everybody's fallible. Kenya, not Uganda. No, definitely Uganda. Palestine, Israel was not a separate province. Correct. It was part of Syria. Eliezer ben Yehuda was from Chabad. I don't know what that means. But he was definitely not a religious Jew. I don't know anything about Kenya. It's definitely known as the Uganda Plan. Perhaps the borders changed, and what we call Kenya was actually Uganda. I do not know. The Jews that never left Israel, what language did they speak? The Jews that stayed in Israel did continue to speak some Hebrew, but mostly not, meaning they're speaking Arabic because everybody around them is Arabic. It's also not so many people, right? And different communities who are joining at different times, right? So you have the Hasidim who are coming in the 18th century, but the ones who never left, we don't have so many. The Samaritans, the Shomronim, who are really the only ones who never, never left, mostly they're speaking Arabic because they're living among the Arabs. Israel Museum shows a lot from early Bezalel. Yes, true. Yes, the Turkish Ottomans were not good in many ways. Sarah Aronson was betrayed by Jews. So like I said, Hillel Halkin wrote this interesting book. The Yeshiva did not support Neely. That's very clear. But the final actual betrayal was when they discovered this bird, right? and brought, led them back to Sarah Anderson. But yes, it definitely was not a lot of sympathy for Neely. The British War Monument is right behind the central bus station in Jerusalem. I'm not addressing the Uganda because I think it's just a question of borders changing. Romaima, yes. When Samuel returned to Britain, he led the Liberal Party and supported Hitler. I did not know that. That's very upsetting to hear. Where did Muslim immigrants come from? Well, you had interesting, you had Bosnian Muslims who were brought here to Caesarea, actually. But they're coming from other countries all around. Yes, and there are no sources, and there is going to be a recording. I cannot give you a link to the pictures, I'm sorry. Okay, that's not very surprising, meaning everybody in those days is coming from a religious home, but like I said, many of them are forsaking it. But I did not know the Chabad connection, so thank you. Other comments, other questions? Handing it over to you, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. Okay, very good. All right, this evening, 8:30 p.m., Rabbi Nati Helfgott from Teaneck, New Jersey, and SAR will be giving our weekly Parsha Shiur. 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning, I'll be giving our weekly Pirkei Avot Shiur. And then we continue Sunday, Rabbi Daniel Feldman on the Mitzvot Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, in English, but human interpersonal relationships, Mitzvot, and Rabbi Liebtag on preparing for Har Sinai. And then on Monday, Ari Shvat, who's teaching sort of the religious aspect and the different views of Hakamat HaMedina from a religious Zionist view. So in many ways, you know, complementary to your history analysis. So that's Monday morning at 11 a.m. and 11. And then evening Mark Shapiro's class, Tuesday, or Wiskin on Chassidut, and Ilana Goldstein-Sachs on Megillat Ruth, and then Wednesday, Marty Lection on Pshat Rosh and Halacha, and Lori Novak on Woman and Kriyat HaTorah started yesterday. Both were excellent shiurim yesterday that got started. And then back to usually next Thursday. We just went through the whole week, I think.
I am tired.
I know.
Okay. I would definitely encourage joining Rabbi Schwat. He's brilliant, and I'm sure it will be a very interesting complement to the stuff we've been doing here. Everything else too, but specifically.
It's interesting. I missed his first two classes as I was teaching at Chad. I can come this Monday. My schedule has changed, but I just listened actually to his first year. Very, very fascinating. The one before Yom HaTzur on the seven views of Medinat Yisrael from a religious point of view is very, very interesting. And we think all the shiurim are good and interesting. That's why we have them. But yes, I would recommend. And one of our new speakers this term, we always like to mix the old and the new. Offer all kinds of insights of Torah from many different perspectives and views. So, okay, Shuli, we'll see you next week. Please, God, enjoy the 34 degree. Well, you know what? I don't know that what I like better, 34 degrees. 34 is too hot for me. You know, so
I agree.
The snow is, you know, I grew up in the snow, so, you know, I kind of like in the middle, but, 23 degrees Celsius, that's the way it should be.
Anyway, all right.
Okay.
Enjoy, everyone. Okay. Goodbye, okay. Shalom. Thank you.
All right.
So
we'll see you this evening, 8:30, Rabbi Helfgott. Okay. All the best, everybody.
Yes, Gaia. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.